Today on the Monocle Weekly, edition 80, there's trouble on the Med, as the Union for the Mediterranean Annual Summit can't quite cast off and get underway.
We've got to make this cumbersome machine, which was the EuroMed partnership, more sensitive to the immediate needs of the region.
That was Dr. Claire Spencer from UK-based policy think tank Chatham House, and we'll also be finding out what it takes to be a winner at the European Business Awards.
Innovation, financial success, clearly, and we think it's very important that business take a socially responsible attitude, so one of the other criteria is ethics.
That was Adrian Tripp, CEO of the European Business Awards, and later in the program we'll be talking to author and international relations expert Parag Khanna about how to run the world.
Diplomacy has been so much about crisis response rather than a consistent structure for management, and that's what diplomacy is supposed to be, and that's what I'm trying to get at in this book.
And now, The Monocle Weekly with Tyler Brulé, Andrew Tuck and Robert Bound.
Hello, it's Sunday, November 21st, 2010, and you're with The Monocle Weekly here in London. I'm Tyler Brulé, along with a rather fluey Andrew Tuck.
Hello.
I'm going to be sneezing and spluttering.
Okay,
it's horrible.
That's just a warning to the listeners. And Robert Bounds here. But you're in fine form, aren't you?
I'm fine.
Okay,
that was
good.
The second injunction that Sesame Street will be filing against you. Not only the brick wall, the Blumo brick wall from last week.
Right. And now?
A new Elmo impression or whatever it was of Andrew.
Do you have a day today, Rob?
Yeah, no. You know me.
It's awards day today.
Ah. Oh, cool, thank you.
Why would that be?
I thought you had a large... What have you got?
Well, I've got the new issue.
Oh.
Look at the size of that.
Try wearing that around your neck.
Absolutely. This is the, Andrew, what is it, 390-some pages. Hopefully, many people listening have already received it. But it is our December-January issue, and it's also the inaugural issue for our first ever soft power survey.
I know, and it's something we're actually rather proud of. We looked at the 25 countries.
It's
in
quite
the world.
Heavy. I know you've got a call to don't
pick
it up. You're weak of limb today.
I know. You need to be strong. It's actually also, this is your workout for the new year, this magazine. We've got little kind of maneuvers that you could do with it to get fit in the new year. But yes, the soft power survey looks at the 25 leading countries who get their way in the world without kind of bombs and bullets and without threats, but by using those elements of soft power, which is everything we've judged everything from aid to national kind of TV brands like France 24 or Al Jazeera, through to the kind of accidental things of soft power, how countries get a very good impression abroad because of their football teams or because of their pop stars.
Well, we don't want to give away the winners or even, you know, who are certainly in the running. And we guess we looked at probably some 40 countries, which as a starting point, and then narrow the field
exactly
down to?
To 25. There's 25 in the top list. And they're an incredible kind of bunch of countries doing, some countries where the soft power works despite the best efforts of the government almost, and other countries where they exactly know what soft power is and they talk about it in their ministries and they're determined to kind of do it better.
Well, here's our Louise Banbury and Tom Morris with the rankings.
Kicking off Monocle's inaugural soft power survey, at number 25 is Turkey, for its notable success in bridging Europe and Asia.
Up next, the world-renowned Emirates airline has ensured the UAE a place in the survey, touching down number 24.
India's at 23, with its landmark cultural exports of cuisine, Bollywood and cricket, marred by this year's Commonwealth Games.
22 is Mexico, followed closely by Brazil at 21, reaping the rewards from former President Lula's soft power tactics.
Despite the odds, a mixture of Nelson Mandela and the success of the 2010 Football World Cup lands South Africa at number 20.
South Korea is at 19, followed by Israel at number 18.
Billions spent on foreign aid, an expansion of its international media reach, and the success of the Beijing Olympics in 2008 give China its spot at number 17.
Italy's in at number 16, with a whole host of soft power assets, from fashion and cuisine to artwork and architecture.
At 15 is Japan. The country may have some diplomatic problems with its neighbours, but Japanese culture continues to be readily devoured by people all over the world.
Peacemaking Norway ranks at number 14, followed by Singapore at 13.
Successful musical exports and a reputation for contributing to global peacekeeping operations lands Canada a place at number 12.
In at number 11, it's the Netherlands, while Spain ranks next at number 10, its endless sporting victories overriding the bad press for its troubled economy.
Finland comes in at number 9, gaining global visibility through its world-renowned education system and for its cultural and academic institutions popping up overseas.
An attractive climate, a host of world-famous performers and entertainers, and a huge presence in the international sporting arena gives Australia its place at number 8.
Denmark ranks number 7, followed closely by its neighbour Sweden at number 6.
With some of the best embassies and diplomats in the world, a multilingual populace, several iconic corporate brands, and some great chocolate, Switzerland comes in at number 5.
The world-class soft power player, Germany, grabs the number 4 spot.
At number 3 is the USA, with its music and TV culture still the most popular around the world, and the reputation of President Obama much more of a hit abroad than at home.
Which brings us to the top 2 ranking countries. In Monocle's first soft power survey, the UK and France rank joint first place. Both countries may have their problems, but their colourful histories, highly respected media, some of the most famous cultural and educational institutions in the world, and the diplomatic and business benefits they draw upon from colonial days means that they continue to be world-class players on the soft power stage.
That was Tom Morris and Louise Banbury, our Monocle editors. It was interesting because earlier in the week I did the World Service, and I think, well, Andrew, no, you did Radio 5 in London.
You love this because I did Radio 5 that went out at 3:20 in the morning. So every taxi driver in London knows about soft power now.
And I did the 10 a.m. slot on the World Service.
Wonder how that happened, eh? Funny that, isn't it?
Rob, we'll see which one you get next week.
I sung the top 25 on X Factor.
Did you?
So you can both chill out.
You know what's exciting? This is just another bit of late-breaking news. X Factor, I don't know if we talked about this last week or not, but the gentleman who's going to be directing our new TV program on Bloomberg, Jonathan Bullen, is the director of X Factor.
Oh my God!
Did you know that?
You better have some moves.
Oh, I'm gonna have some moves. I want you to get your hair cut though, because there's gonna be a lot of There's gonna be a lot of pyrotechnics. Right. That's the problem.
Or dry ice.
You're a bit bushy in the back.
Dry ice is cold. It's not gonna catch me on fire.
No, I already. It's already in the contract with Bloomberg. I said I want fire and I want pyrotechnics.
Okay, that's nice.
Yeah, it's good. No.
What did they say?
They said absolutely. Yeah.
They said good.
Also, we put in for an accessories budget because I've been watching a lot of the presenters on Bloomberg. There's a lot going on from shoulder up. That's what it's about.
What are you going to do?
I mean, not just the intelligence of the presenters, of course.
I was going to say, the shoulder up, you're kind of limited. We're talking about necklaces, nose rings, earrings.
Well, yeah, something like that.
High quality.
Scarves, bow ties.
High quality eyewear.
Yeah.
Military style epaulettes, that'd be nice.
Stetson.
Anyway, back to the World Service. When I was on the World Service, Andrew...
Yes.
With
at 10 o'clock in the morning, yeah.
Yes, with and Christine O'Krent, who looks after France 24, very respected journalist. She loved the survey. She thought it was great. She wants to do it again.
And is that, do you think, got anything to do with where France came?
Oh, yes. Well, you know, might have done. Yeah, she was thrilled about the fact. I thought she was going to give me a hard time because I just thought they were going to bring someone on who said, oh, you know, France doesn't deserve the role. But she was thrilled about it. And part of it is, just going back to what you were saying before we did the ranking, you know, it is the importance that something like TV5, Radio France International, I think France 24, and then I think certainly the institutions in this country, not least of which, you know, we're talking about our own, but the likes of the BBC, the FT, I think The Economist. I mean, you can't really discount how important I think those are in terms of actually getting a global message out there.
I think one of the things I really loved in this was about CCTV, which is, you know, obviously the Chinese TV broadcaster, and their ambitions to kind of really kind of break into every other language you can think of. You know, so they're doing a Portuguese service, they're doing a Spanish service, but the funny thing is you just know that it's actually not quite as persuasive about the brand of the nation as something like the World Service, because actually the World Service isn't actually trying to sell Britain, but because it doesn't do that, in a way it makes Britain come across as actually quite open and fair and equal. Whereas some of these...
You're saying CCTV won't be like that? Is that what
well,
you're saying?
Well, it's funny, you know...
It's our own show,
we have...
That's turned to shock radio, Andrew.
I like it in the office when people kind of click onto the TV station and it's, you know, Russia Today or something. And... You know, there's some reasonable journalism that goes on there, of course, but a lot of it is just so kind of clunky, it's kind of predictability. And I don't know that that's good money for the Russian government to spend, because, you know, in the end, people watch it and they're slightly sniggering.
And probably not such great money for Beijing to spend either.
No.
Right. Rob, on the culture side of things, though, do you think that... I mean, it just is when you look at... A UK versus France, and I know we had the debate when we were doing the survey that, okay, can you name, you know, necessarily, you know, 5 French pop acts right now or a French television format that has gone global recently? Perhaps not. You can certainly do that with the UK. But, you know, the French, you know, do score well we certainly had, obviously, a very animated discussion, you know, not just about cuisine, but also, let's say, what brand France brings to the world, whether it's high-speed trains, you know, whether it's the world of luxury goods and just brands. Do you think that, I mean, for some of these, you know, some of the countries, you know, that, you know, I think anyone who's in our top 25 has done well, but, you know, is it a big ask for, you know, let's say a UAE, you know, or for even, let's say, an Italy, to move up the rankings if they're not going to improve the state of what Rye does internationally, or, you know, if the UAE doesn't, you know, get some sort of basic journalistic issues in check?
Well, I think in terms of those, in terms of something like France and Italy, France, you know, France is always, I feel, sort of wastes some of the talent of its contemporary art scene. It's nothing to compare with the UK's, but also possibly Italy does. They seem like older states, you know, compared to the UK. France and Italy feel like older parts of older Europe, you know, in some sense. And then as far as the UAE is concerned, I think lots of people are very happy, actually, about its sort of artistic ambitions. But it's buying it in. Mm. You know, it's buying its art in, or it's buying its art buying expertise in from France with the Louvre and all that sort of thing. So people I think are slightly cynical about that. But I bet you they'll still go and see it.
Mm. Andrew?
Yeah, and I think the fascinating thing about UAE is actually it's this airline that's actually its best soft power sell. You know, the Emirates actually persuades people to think that UAE is, you know, a powerful, interesting country that's good at, you know, good at service, even if the people on board aren't actually from the UAE. It's actually been a very good thing for the soft selling of UAE around the world.
Yeah, and I'd also say something like Emirates, you never really get the impression that the people that staff the aeroplanes, no matter where they're from, are miserable and hate their jobs. And I wouldn't say that about some of the flag carriers, some of the nations that are fairly close to home.
No, it's interesting.
You know, and I think that is a really big, that's a good thing and a big deal, actually.
Are you talking about someone like, or carrier like Aer Lingus, maybe?
I wasn't saying it. Even closer to home than Aer Lingus, actually.
it was funny because when you do the listing and you get so close to all these countries, then, you know, just given everything that's happened in Ireland really over the last 10 days, it's funny to go back and say, oh, you know, actually, Ireland's actually not even on there. And
they do get one good mention, actually. They get a good mention on Eurovision, on the song contest, because they've won Eurovision more than anybody else. And what's interesting is that Eurovision song contest, you know, that often it's the song that wins that. Mm. It goes around, maybe not in the UK, but goes around Europe and actually makes people think about that country for a good few months. So Israel's a very good example of that, where actually the state government, to be blunt, is just useless soft power, and you only have to kind of watch its kind of, you know, its spokesman on TV to kind of see how much they care about what the world interprets them on that soft power level. But actually, a city level, for example, something like Tel Aviv, they're amazing at it, and they're very good at kind of getting across this image of being embracing and wanting to bring in the world. But actually, on a pop level, they're also very successful. So when you had Dana International, you know, drag queen, winning it and going around the world, actually made people like Israel. It made people think this is a country that can cope with people who are different, and they're funny and they're entertaining. And so actually Eurovision is a good ticket for people.
Oh, maybe that's also the issue with Ireland as well. I mean, that poor RTE television, I mean, they're still paying the damn thing off. Hence the crisis, right?
The Eurovision crisis.
I think it's something like that. Will we do it all again? We're going to do it again next year, aren't we?
Oh, gosh, yes.
What we're going to change?
There should be more Eurovision.
More Eurovision.
I think it's a bit too, you know.
I think it will change anyway, because what's fascinating is that I thought what was interesting is lots of the things which people don't like at home are actually quite good abroad. So, for example, when you look at something like Obama or even like Sarkozy, having a hell of a time at home. But actually, when you go out on the world stage, Obama is still good for brand America. And actually, people still like Sarkozy and Carla Bruni. They still make France look cool and sexy and interesting and intriguing, even if they're a disaster at home. So I think those things will just change.
And here comes a royal wedding.
I know, in England.
Good God. Yes. England's in with a shot again next year. Well, Jen, we're going to be continuing this discussion a bit later on in the show when we talk to author and international relations expert Parag Khanna about his new book, How to Run the World. But first, where are we going, Rob? Going down to the Med. Because this weekend, the 43 member countries of the Union for the Mediterranean were due to meet in Barcelona. During the week, it emerged that the Union's co-presidents, France and Egypt, made the decision to delay the summit for the second time this year, as Middle East peace talks remain deadlocked. A little over 2 years old, is the Union proving to be just as fragile as parts of the region itself? And what does the future look like for one of the world's most volatile territories? Well, joining us now in studio is Claire Spencer, head of the Middle East and North Africa program at Chatham House here in London. Welcome.
Thank you.
We covered the story at the very beginning. It seemed to be this quite sensible big dream of Mr. Sarkozy. And very much on paper, it made sense. And certainly when they kicked off for the first time. But where has it derailed? Because you would think there's enough to get on with in other parts of the Mediterranean that they should be able to soldier along.
Well, I think it's a function of size. They've included, as you say, 43 different actors. This includes the Palestinian Authority. So you can't say 43 states. And it's also a follow-on policy to the Barcelona process, which has been around, as your article probably covered, since 1995. And the idea was, as Sarkozy initially put it, was it was going to be a project of projects, projet de projet. And the idea was, you know, to get away from the large, cumbersome thing, which, in fact, ironically, it's become, to actually focus on joint projects which all the region needs. So there are ideas for depolluting the Mediterranean. Most of the members, in fact, the idea is most of the members are focused on the Mediterranean basin, if you include the EU27. I mean, some of us aren't anywhere near the Mediterranean in the European Union. But the idea is there's a common interest in promoting these things. And one of the issues which sadly fell by the wayside and was very urgent was a water accord, which was also pretty much agreed, I understand, from diplomats involved. It was 99%. The ink was nearly dry. And then, as ever, it was derailed because of disagreements between Israel and Palestine. The Israelis, I believe, objected to wording in there about occupied territories, which you'd think in international documents is quite often used. But they came to a compromise with the European Commission, who's also part of this, to call it territories under occupation, whereupon, of course, the Arab states said, no, we want the language of occupied territories. It has international legal ramifications, and playing around like this means we won't sign it. So the whole accord, the substance of which is desperately needed, of the 450 million people who live around the Mediterranean in the coastal states, 20 million of them don't have access to drinking water. This is something that regional cooperation could and should quite easily address. But because and unless all of these members of the Union for the Mediterranean agree, it's not going to go ahead.
So it sounds like part of it is it's also become a grand projet of grand projet just by sheer number and maybe the ambitions.
Yeah, I think it's the size is the problem. I mean, why not foresee a more flexible approach in which if, say, there's one member state of the Union who doesn't agree, you say, well, the rest of us are going ahead with this, and as and when you're ready, you can sign up. But obviously, in this case, the state in question was Israel, and there's other sensitivities involved, and perhaps some on the European side wouldn't have signed up anyway. So this hasn't been possible. But if you go right back to the beginning of the idea, I think Sarkozy's vision was to have just the littoral states, to have far fewer people. I don't think he was intending to include the whole of the European Union. It's only when he mentioned the European Commission that, in fact, the Germans, with the British very closely behind, said, hang on, well, if the Commission's involved and they're paying for any of this, then everybody else has to have a seat at the table. And I don't know what stage the Balkan states, who were not part of the original Euro-Mediterranean partnership that existed before, were brought on board. They're not posing a problem, but as ever, just under the Euro-Mediterranean partnership, the lack of an agreement between Israel and the Palestinians means that this is often used to stop some of the other projects going ahead.
Israel and the Palestine Authority aside, do you think, if we look at a way forward, it's going back to the littoral states, then, I mean, maybe that's what they have to do and literally restrict it. Unless you've got water rights, you're not going to be sitting at the table.
Well, there's other ways of doing this. There's already something called the 5+5, which is five Southern European states. Let me see if I can remember who they are. It's Portugal, Spain, France, Italy and Malta, with the five members of the not very active, but anyway, that exists, the Union for the Maghreb. And they meet occasionally. They still meet to talk mostly at sort of interior minister level about security issues. But I mean, that provides, it seems to me, in terms of economic development, a much more flexible platform where you can actually get Spaniards, French, you can get joint ventures together, which apply to Morocco. You can talk about energy across that part of the region. Obviously, Algeria is an energy exporter. Morocco is a net importer. They have their own problem at the moment over the Western Sahara. Sahara, but there are more flexible ways of addressing issues which are pertinent to the Western Mediterranean, which needn't be infected, if you like, or affected by what goes on in the Eastern Mediterranean.
And do you think that was Sarkozy's original idea to bring Algiers and Tunis and Tripoli and Rabat closer certainly to Paris's doorstep?
Well, this is the irony. I think his approach, and I certainly welcomed it when he actually made the announcement that he had this sort of thing in mind before he was even elected president. It was seen as, come on, we've got to make this cumbersome machine, which was the Euromed partnership, more sensitive to the immediate needs of the region. And then bit by bit, as people came on board, and as I say, I think the big mistake was to include the European Commission. If he'd said, okay, this is going to be an entirely privately funded, bilaterally, loosely funded organization, which will complement the Euro-Mediterranean partnership rather than replace it, he might have got somewhere with it.
Do you think that there's a certain sense of urgency, and maybe from Chatham House's point of view, that there's a need to bring the Maghreb closer into the European fold, much sooner rather than later?
Well, I mean, it's funny enough, we're having a conference at Chatham House looking at the EU's neighbourhood policies, and I'm going to be arguing the case that we need to be, especially in view of new economic realities, much more light-footed in this part of the world. As we see, everyone's talking about the Chinese, the Asian tigers moving in. There's much more Gulf investment in North Africa. None of this at the moment is captured at all by EU policies, which start and stop with the EU itself and then look at the rest of the world in terms of hubs and spokes. So you have a policy towards the Mediterranean, as we've just discussed. There's also attempts to engage in cooperation between the EU and GCC. There's a completely different approach to Iran, which is the EU troika plus the UN system, and the nuclear issue dominates there. There's completely different, in fact, hardly any approach really collectively towards Iraq. Yemen is seen as an aid basket case. None of these things have actually any ability at the moment to capture what's going on horizontally, how the Indians and Chinese are moving into the region and how the Gulf is affecting what goes on within the broader Arab world. And I think the EU is actually, as a result, being decimated by this. It's the individual states are competing with each other rather than there being a collective vision and a collective attempt to say, look, we have this economic strength collectively. We need to use it more imaginatively towards North Africa, particularly when it comes to visas, migrants, workers, etc.
Claire, I wanted to ask a question, which is, when this first began, there was a suspicion that actually what Sarkozy was doing was also trying to hold back the Turks, for example, from kind of wanting to be part of the EU, that at the very baseline of it, that there was already a fault line, that there was a negative involved here. It was trying to say to these people, you're not going to be part of the EU, just take a step back. We'll almost make something to kind of keep you entertained on the sidelines. Do you think that was a fair suspicion that was also going on? And do you think that has had ramifications about the success of what he's tried to do?
Well, I think there's an element of that. And obviously, France for some time now has been seen as at the forefront of blocking Turkey's entrance into the EU. So I think the Turks are right to be suspicious. But as I say, it's not the way this Union for the Mediterranean looks now. It's the central blocking feature of it is Israel-Palestine. And I think the Turks, frankly, are the kind of actor we should be looking to as a model for being light-footed around this region. You know, they are in the business of doing business with everybody. They're not imposing self-denying ordinances on talking to Hamas or Hezbollah or, you know, trying to draw Syria into a Western fold. They're much more realistic about what's really going on in this region. And I think that's where Sarkozy's ideas have been overtaken by events, certainly even since he launched this policy.
I wondered how aware the Mediterranean states are of the Union of the Mediterranean. Is it something that relies on popular support, or is it something, as you say, at interior minister sort of level?
Yeah, it's an intergovernmental structure. And I mean, if it worked, the idea would be that the governments of the region would agree the framework within which cooperation takes place. And then, you know, the private sector leaps into the void, as it were, knowing what the rules of the game are because they've been agreed, and merrily get on with investing, and you have youth cooperation and cultural exchanges and all that sort of thing. I think what they failed to notice is that the private sector, A, is doing it already. Why do they need the Union for the Mediterranean? And this also is a design fault. The Union for the Mediterranean has got no new funding lines. And as we can see with the recession in Europe, isn't likely to get any more funding lines. So they need the private sector to step in and say, OK, are you going to fund, for example, solar energy development in North Africa? That's a new bright idea. What I question is, does the private sector actually need the Union for the Mediterranean? Why do you need to go and ask somebody's permission in Barcelona, whether you as a private investor are actually going to, you know, have talks with the Moroccans about siting a few solar panels in the Sahara? I mean, it just doesn't add up. And I think this is where the invisibility, if you like, the lack of popular support, the lack of a clear role for civil society writ large. I mean, you know, we're talking about labour organisations as well as, you know, NGOs, just doesn't feature in here at all.
And does it have a sort of different complexion? Obviously, the Mediterranean states have a different complexion to the rest of the EU or the broader EU. Is it a more is it sort of being sold as a slightly more fun thing to go on?
Well, I'm talking about this, you know, the broader conception of the EU, inevitably, because this is, and we're talking particularly about the Mediterranean and North Africa here, this is in the backyard of Spain, Portugal, France, Italy. Of course, they're going to have bilateral interests and indeed, in the case of Spain and Morocco, bilateral spats every so often about controlling borders and various other things. They're going to have far more interest in the way they deal with these states than, say, Finland or even the British. I mean, we produced at Chatham House a special edition on North Africa where the introductory chapter I wrote was why the British should care about North Africa, because you continually say this, but they can't really see, apart from, you know, the suggestion of setting up some English language schools or something, that they just can't see the way into investing there, whereas the Spaniards bilaterally and the French are extremely involved in states like Morocco, and the interests of others tends to be in states like Libya, as we've seen with the British, and Algeria because of energy needs. So everyone is sitting under a collective umbrella, but actually pursuing rather protectionist, if I may depict them as such, national interest under this umbrella.
Dr. Claire Spencer from Chatham House, thanks for joining us. You're listening to The Monocle Weekly. We're back after this. You're back with The Monocle Weekly here in London. Earlier in the week, the annual European Business Awards ceremony was held in Paris. Now in its fourth year, the programme aims to recognise excellence, best practice and innovation in the European business community in line with the aims of the European Union. The diverse group of entrants range from fish farming and renewable energy to light aircraft to skincare businesses. But who scooped the top awards? Well, we've got a bit of a list here. I'll start with the first one. The award for corporate sustainability went to Fair Trade Foundation in the UK.
The award for customer focus went to Etiketten Carini in Austria.
Employer of the Year award and Sam Hood in the Netherlands.
Tim, I wonder if you're nominated or not. The Environmental Awareness Award went to AP Møller Mærsk out of Denmark.
The HSBC Growth Strategy of the Year award went to Infinis, which is a UK company.
The RSM International Entrepreneur of the Year award went to Terry Clune, founder and CEO of TaxBack in Ireland.
Do you think we'll have a tax back in Ireland this week? Probably.
I think that website's crashed.
The UKTI Award for Innovation went to Pipistrel of Slovenia, a company I think that we've covered, Andrew, who make light aircraft.
We have. And the Infosys Business of the Year Award went to Millicom International Cellular, which is based in Luxembourg.
The Infosys Business of the Year Award for turnovers of less than 60 million euros went to Softonic in Spain.
I want a Softonic.
I've got one here. Do you hear the fizz?
And finally, the chairman's selection went to the Whistle Group of Georgia. I think we should talk to Adrian Tripp right now. He's the CEO of the awards. He's joining us on the line. He's just back in London. Hello, Adrian.
Hi, Tyler. How are you?
Very well. I guess to start, just given where the world has been from a business and economic perspective over the last 2 years, did the criteria change for the 2010 awards, or was it pretty much the same? And you know, in terms of looking at the broader field, do you think that perhaps, certainly from the judges' point of view and how you sort of rated all of this, did the criteria change?
The criteria didn't change for the awards. I think in the analysis over the last 4 years, we saw a marked change in the performance of companies coming through. So the previous 2 years, literally every business that was involved in the awards in some way, shape or another was struggling to deal with the financial challenges and the recession. Whereas you've seen this year, a lot of these companies started coming out pretty early. Sort of 2009, you started to see quite a big uplift, and 2010's performance has been spectacular. And there's a very big difference in the performance in the businesses this year than they were last year.
Just maybe to rewind a second, what are the key metrics that you work with when you come up, I guess, with a shortlist, and obviously to get to your list of winners?
Yeah, there are three principles behind the awards. To be able to judge big companies and small companies, we think that there are three characteristics which are essential to all businesses. So innovation, everybody has to keep innovating, you can't stand still. Financial success, clearly, you have to make some money or break even, otherwise the model doesn't work. And then we think it's very important that business take a socially responsible attitude. So one of the other criteria is ethics. So we evaluate businesses across those three particular criteria in all categories, and then we have, perhaps in the customer focus area, obviously some specialism in that area. We'll dig down a bit deeper into that.
I mean, it is well and truly a diverse field that we've got, you know, the likes of course, you know, AP Moller Maersk, and then you have someone like, you know, Ensam Hood from the Netherlands. I'm not going to sort of nail you down to say just name one. That would be great. But if you had to perhaps send your CV off to three companies, who would you like to work for?
I'd like to work for any one of the 100, to be honest. But if I give you some examples of things which I think are really innovative from a European perspective, I mean, we're always looking at ways that Europe can be more successful and what we should be encouraging in terms of the, you know, the economic makeup of this massive trading area. And I'd say there's, you know, a great example of innovation in Pipistrel, which is a Slovenian company which has come up with the first electric aircraft, a proper aircraft that can carry its batteries and still fly for quite a long way. So that's fascinating. I think you mentioned Ensam Hood. It's just a really clever business model which they've been able to apply using the value profit chain from Harvard, which has been fascinating. And then I think they're from sort of an unknown, which if you were going to go out and apply in that marketplace, you wouldn't have heard of. But when you find out about them, you're amazed. Is Millicom, the large business of the year in this awards. You know, you wouldn't know that this is a European-based company, big cellular operator, but 7,000 employees in Latin America and Africa, and one of the biggest mobile operators in those market spaces. So, and they've all got very interesting and pretty unique business models. So, yeah, really clever, really innovative businesses that have got it all connected up. You know, they've got happy customers. They've got operate in a socially responsible way. They've got innovative products. They compete in internationally, which is really important. And all their staff, you know, have got great work-life balances and are really committed to what they're doing. So I think at this particular moment in time, those businesses are nearly as close to as you can get to perfection for a moment in time in business. So,
What was the mood like? And I ask this because, you know, we've come off the back of a week where all eyes have been, you know, firmly focused on Asia, and, you know, off the back of certainly APEC and the G20, and we've had so much focus, you know, no matter where you look, on what the Koreans are up to, what is China doing, what is Singapore doing. How are the Europeans, you know, how are they feeling, do you think?
You know, it was a theme that came through very strongly in the forum and sort of discussions over the last few days. I mean, you've got top 100 businesses here in Europe, and, you know, they're all talking about internationalization and how the world is going to change over the next 10 to 20 years and what that actually means and how they develop and devise business strategies that both capitalize on globalization and those big emerging markets and what they're actually doing, but also sort of understand how they can still make sure that in their home markets, perhaps, that they remain competitive and they're able to compete with competitors that are coming in over here. So, and, you know, it's interesting, it's fascinating, a couple of the big organizations that you sat and chatted to, I mean, two CEOs separately without prompting said, you know, I think in 5 to 10 years, the CEO of our business, and we're a European-wide business, will be Asian. As we move into those marketplaces, you know, they're going to become much more important to them, and our overall business will be headed up by somebody from the Asian continent. So, you know, it's interesting. People know, and they're starting to do stuff about it, but it was interesting that all of these companies had pretty well thought through strategies. It was on their agenda, even if they weren't, you know, weren't operating in those marketplaces. They had a very strong international perspective and were working out how to partner in those markets and how to get into there and develop joint ventures so that they took advantage of it and they didn't see it from a defensive perspective particularly. You know, they saw opportunity rather than just threat. So, you know, everybody's aware of it, but I think what sort of defined these businesses is they're very progressive and they're very sort of positive in their outlooks, and naturally they're looking for opportunity rather than worrying about trying to defend what they've got.
Adrian Tripp, CEO of the European Business Awards, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks, Tyler.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
See you. Bye-bye.
Andrew, it's interesting when you listen to that sense of some European countries not necessarily being rattled, but certainly looking over the horizon, and there's that feeling that you know, as Adrian was saying, that look out sort of 36 months, 5 years time, that it will be perhaps an Asian CEO at the helm. But I'm wondering if you think they may be beating themselves up too much, because the one thing that we come back to just off the back of, let's say, even the small business survey that we have in this issue. There is something that companies are doing in the Netherlands, in Austria, in Denmark, where there's real investment in workplace. There is a real investment in creating this sort of human scale. And as much as I think we like a lot of companies, in Japan and Korea and elsewhere, sometimes when you go beyond the reception desk, it's pretty grim on the factory floor. And I mean, I'm talking sort of factory floor as office floor.
Yeah, I think that's completely true. I think what's fascinating is when you look at some of these bigger companies operating in Asia, it really reminds you of what was happening in Britain or in Europe, 150 years ago. There are people living on the factory site whose lives are completely taken over by the companies they work for in a very bad way. And people still ignore that when they buy those products here in the West. And I think there's a kind of model of doing business which is about sustainability, it's about looking after the people that work for you. And those things are really important. And I do think it's important that we don't just give up on those things, that those are the things that make European brands often very successful and actually very appealing to an Asian audience as well. In China, in India, people see these as kind of benchmark companies. And if they try to water down what they're doing, I think that's a bad thing.
I mean, Rob, even at one of our favorite magazines in Tokyo, when I was at their head office recently, I actually noticed that there were a lot of pillows and blankets in the office, not because they were doing a houseware shoot. It's because, seriously, a lot of editors are quite literally camping out under the desk, which I don't know if that's ever happened to you before.
I mean, I've let myself in of an evening. It's good to have hi-fi and a good drinks cabinet in the office. That's kind of largely your fault.
But do you think that it's interesting when you look at the North American side? It's very much still, I think, sort of driven. How quickly are you going to take your startup to IPO level, or how quickly will you hope that Google snatches you up? And yeah, you might have sort of a funky workplace, and then as you go to Asia, and even I think some of the best companies, which are not in manufacturing, they're in the service sector, but it's still bad strip lighting and it's tiny footprints for desks, and I'm wondering if perhaps European business needs to be sort of a bit more ballsy, saying well, there's something else that we're doing here, which is there is a bit more of a humanitarian scope to what we bring to also the value chain for a product.
Yeah, and it's really, I mean, it's I think to echo what Andrew is saying, I think that's something that does probably exist in that zone a little more than perhaps in the Asian zone. But it's a difficulty of letting your customers know that that's how your products are made, and that's without overselling it. But it was interesting listening to the interview there. It sounded sort of like a sort of Dragon's Den almost idea of we have this company from this country doing this, and they've done this, and it sounded like a real sort of top 10 idea. And if all these companies are keeping their employees happy and employees not looking to go elsewhere, then that's kind of good news for itself. And I guess it builds the brand that are European companies.
And I've got good news for Rob, Andrew, because I just signed off on your new desk. It's got a bunk underneath it in the office, which is fantastic.
Single or double?
Merry Christmas. Wait and see. You have to do the Monocle Weekly from London. We're back after this. You're back with the Monocle Weekly here in London, where it's time to hear from Robert Bound. How do you sound, Andrew?
I'm all right, actually.
Okay, good.
Can I just say one thing before we start?
Are those your limbs?
No, that's a creaky floorboard on the desk.
Oh,
that's quite good, isn't it? I've got a sound effect.
The sound of his glands.
Exactly.
Neck brackets.
Yeah. Rheumatoid tuck.
You're worried that you can upstage that now, aren't you?
Let me do it one more time.
It's like a squeaky floorboard.
Something, yeah. Yeah.
This reminds me of that line from The Thick of It, where the sort of elder diplomat says, "You're like Dick and Dom, only neither of you are Doms." where are you least?
I'm
likely
computing
to
that now. Where are you? There might be a fight after this.
Where are you least likely to catch the flu? Where would you be on a? Where would you rather be on a sort of on an overcast Sunday in London?
Where would I least like to be?
Where would you most like to be instead? Oh. Where's the opposite?
The opposite.
Of the spectrum?
I'd like to be on my big cozy sofa, I think.
All right. Well, you can. What about the North Beaches of Sydney? Because that's where we're going to go musically.
Oh, are we? But can we just talk about, just speaking
you
of
cozy.
You want
to talk about your sofa?
Well, no. I want to talk about my jumper. Have you seen my radio jumper?
I was going to talk about that, but now you've ruined it.
Let's talk about it now. It's got a shawl collar. It's got leather buttons. But it's because I think oftentimes, I think it's important to dress for radio, isn't it? Because then people just think we show up in our sweatpants and our jammies on a Sunday morning. Mm. But it is still, this is Sense of Occasion Radio.
It definitely is. What are you doing? Doing it in trousers?
No, I'm just saying what I've got on.
No, but it's true. I'm not sure about you, Rob. When you call up Andrew, and say, Andrew, I can't come in today because, you know, I've got to finish my feature for the section. Do you write in your, you know, boxers and tee, or do you have to have a shower? And pull yourself together as a person and then sit down at your laptop, with your laptop, at your laptop.
Yeah. Dress for the office. Yeah. No matter where you are. Well, I can see you looking at me and I know you don't quite believe me, but it's true. I can't do that.
No, I can't do it either.
Yeah.
You can't write in your boxes.
Not really. It gets a bit cold as well. And that doesn't mean that you finish any quicker. And I'm talking about writing.
No, because because sometimes when you come in, I think it's also the change of seasons, you know, where the world is, you know, we're waking up so early on a Sunday morning to come in and do this program. And sometimes you don't want to put on a blazer and a cardigan, do you? Or a tie. And so I thought there needs to be some sort of transitional.
That's good radio.
And I think this is a good radio top.
I slightly regret not buying that one myself.
The company's Universal Works.
That's from Stockholm, isn't it?
It's from Stockholm, but it's made in the UK.
Oh, is it?
Yeah.
Of course, that was when there was almost that kind of like we almost scrap.
Standoff in the shop.
I know, because the medium didn't quite work. You kind of needed a large tube, but there's only one navy left. Sorry about that.
Yeah, whatever.
Anyway,
I've got this.
Let's
just
go to
plain old
Cardi, isn't it?
Plain old Cardi, no leather buttons.
Nope.
No shawl collar.
Let's go to Sydney.
Okay, Julia Stone of Angus and Julia Stone fame has released a solo album, and it's called Julia Stone in the Memory Machine. And it's got a very dramatic cover. This song is called Catastrophe.
Seems like every time we touch, catastrophe awaits us. Seems like every time we touch, devil eyes in danger. And I know that you're just a wager for me to put my last pair of shoes on. And
I like that.
Yeah, she's got a lovely voice.
Yeah, I could see myself driving over the Harbour Bridge listening to that.
Yeah.
Driving over the edge or...
Yeah, that would be catastrophic.
Yeah, that would be a catastrophe.
It would be. No, I liked it.
He said it's a sort of... He does think he's Howard sort of Stern.
He does.
I've got a cold.
Yeah, I know. Well, we're in minute 43 of the programme and we're almost there.
But we like that, don't we? Like Julia. We like Julia's solo effort as much as we like her and her brother together.
Yeah. No, it's very good.
She's pretty cool. And a good autumn listener. I thought it was something to wrap up with. I thought it was sort of it fireside is. And glugging.
Yeah, I was in New York last week.
Oh God! Oh right,
I was. No radio jumpers there though. I was looking for one for you for Christmas.
Was it chilly? Was it too chilly for a radio jumper?
Was it? There's a lot of shawl collars going on, but I didn't think that you would like. They're sort of just like three button affairs. Pull over. What's the point?
Yeah, you need something to top.
And you need pockets. I think you need pockets, don't you?
Does that have a pocket?
It's got a breast pocket here.
Oh, it's got a breast pocket. That's quite useful.
And my pipe's in this one down here.
What's in your top pocket?
We just thought you were pleased to see us.
Just some chewing tobacco. Just some chewing tobacco, Rob. In there.
Anyway, I think I'm going to launch a collection called Radio Works.
Yeah.
No,
good. Yeah.
Yeah. There's a story in this.
Will there be a rocking chair in the shop?
Well, Andrew's already got the rocking sound effect over there. That's a bit. We're going to be talking a lot about what's happening with the world of Monocle Audio over the coming weeks. First, we have to do the TV show.
Get that out of the way.
December 18th is the premiere. I know. Time for your hair.
I've got to go to Miami first.
Oh, do you?
Yeah.
You've got to make a program for us.
So I'm going to get my hair cut, go to Miami, get a suntan, /make film.
And then I'll be fine, won't I? I think we'll be all set.
I think we should perhaps talk to Parag Khanna next about his book called How to Run the World. You're listening to The Monocle Weekly in London. We're back after this. Welcome back to The Monocle Weekly. A new book scheduled for release in January, not in time for Christmas, but just in time for Davos, carries the rather bold title, How to Run the World. Penned by a leading international relations expert and best-selling author, the book offers both a brave account of the current global chaos and also a set of solutions to help return the world to a new level of stability. The author, Parag Khanna, is a director at the New America Foundation, has been named one of the most influential people of the 21st century, and regularly contributes to the world's most respected press, but is yet to be commissioned by Andrew. Why is that, Andrew?
That's all to come.
Okay, good.
He's been building up to that for some years, you see.
it doesn't mean that you're excused from the dreadful oversight.
No. Okay. No. But anyways, Parag Khanna is here in studio. Parag, welcome. Before I start, tell us a little bit about the New America Foundation, because there are many foundations and think tanks that are within the Beltway in Washington. Where does New America sit?
There isn't a Monocle think tank.
Not Washington. Yet. Just you wait.
New America is definitely the new kid on the block in terms of D.C. think tanks. It is nonpartisan, entirely privately funded, and nonpartisan, no political money. Actually, Google is one of our largest sponsors. Eric Schmidt is the chairman of our board. We consider ourselves purveyors of the radical center. So, trying to appeal to all sides of the political spectrum, but with radical, fresh ideas. And I think it's lived up to its name.
Mm. How to Run the World, that's something to live up to as well.
It is.
There are a series of themes, and it's interesting that how micro the book goes in certain parts. And I'm wondering, would you say that these are very much the ideas of the foundation throughout, or are these... It's very much a Parag Khanna narrative.
Right. No, New America is a very entrepreneurial place. We each do our own thing. So this is very much my book, my work, and my methodology is 99% traveling and talking to people, and only 1%. I shouldn't discount, but the value of reading and research and sort of examining the rest of the literature. But usually that literature can be summed up very quickly and then dismissed just as quickly. So I'm looking for fresh ideas on my own, and You say it goes very micro, and that's correct, because it's really the book that's arguing that the local should become the global rather than the global forcing itself on the local. So I'm looking for the best solutions to problems, whether it is environmental sustainability, poverty relief, economic management, community governance. People say nation building. I say community building, and nation building is community building done right. So the message there really is that bottom-up solutions will spread faster than top-down rhetoric.
And is that through hardcore research? And I think this is, Andrew, looking at you, it's a theme that's close to our hearts, because a lot of people, certainly when we put these volumes out, people want to look for hard metrics. And often we say, well, part of what it is being on, well, not just on the plane 99% of the time, but being out there in the world. So I'm wondering how much of it is really just observational, rather than saying, we've went and worked with our associates and hired a number of other firms to just crunch a bunch of data.
No, and that is the value of the existing research. That's what think tanks do. They commission surveys, commission research. That stuff can be useful, but you always want to validate your ideas by going out there and seeing them in action. For example, I've spent quite a bit of time in Afghanistan, and that's a place where I can very clearly separate the wheat from the chaff. You'll get lots of data that will say, the NATO Western presence is beloved by the people, and they would like to have it. And then you can go there and talk to people for yourself. And you can talk to large aid agencies that will say, look, we've spent $15 billion in just a couple of years on aid programs. And then you can go and you can see that the best programs are the ones that cost the least and give money to local councils that distribute and allocate those funds themselves. So one of the things you learn in general from observation, and certainly is an argument in this book, is that numbers, particularly financial numbers, never really correlate to impact and reality. It so much more has to do with the policy, the filtering, and the control, and so forth.
Let's talk about, as you talk about, sort of Khaosistan. And I mean, I guess Khaosistan in many ways, yes, is a reference to Afghanistan, but it's also the neighborhood in general. Solutions. I mean, you talk about something which is, things which are not, the multi-billion-dollar projects that land on a Globemaster necessarily.
Right.
If you had to, and this is obviously, this is rather grand, but of course, if you're going to run the world and you were given a mandate, you know, in Kabul at the moment, what would you do? I mean, what needs to be done right now?
Well, first of all, it's not just Afghanistan. And when I say chaosistan, it's a neologism precisely because it doesn't point to one country, but rather to this much broader space. And that space that I refer to, and there's a large section of the book about it, is the entire post-colonial world. Afghanistan isn't itself a post-colonial country the way Pakistan is, but much of that section is actually about Pakistan. And it's about treating that area is not just the 25 million people of Afghanistan, but the 200 million people across that broader South Central Asian kind of area. And by and large, what I call post-colonial entropy is what I refer to in areas of Africa, the Middle East, and South Asia, where since decolonization, since the 1950s, you have seen the decay of public institutions, rampant corruption, vast overpopulation. And these are the problems that need to fundamentally be addressed, not just this notion that that a place became a failed state after the collapse of the Soviet Union. So whereas a lot of people argue that we have this failed states problem, the no term is more popular now in international relations and so forth, as if that problem was born with the end of the Cold War. In fact, it goes back 60, 70 years. So if you want to deal with it, you have to fundamentally remap certain countries. And this is where it comes to chaosistan, because the agreements that really codify what the AFPAC border is, that date back to the partition of South Asia, have never really been fully recognized. And the question that I'm asking, and the question that NATO and Western forces refuse to ask, is what should the future role of the Pashtun people be? What is it that they would want for themselves? Could they have a parliament of their own that would potentially have a role to play in both modern Afghanistan and modern Pakistan? Why don't we think about totally different structures to accommodate these people? Because certainly there's nothing so particularly legitimate about the Pakistani state today or the Afghan state that we should prioritize them over the 20-some million Pashtun people over whom they govern and rule.
Mm. We've come off the back of a week where we had a very high-profile release of a couple in Somalia. Mm-hmm. And you, of course, you do focus on terror on the high seas. What does someone do with the Horn of Africa? I mean, how do you solve a problem like Somalia as well? I mean, in many ways, is it going for that grassroots approach? Because it's very difficult to watch a release and you hear then a very human story about, someone's parent who's died or lived in captivity. And it's something also very micro and very human about that story that just, it makes you very, very angry when you see a failed state holding the world to ransom. And at the same time, leadership off the coast with the international coalition, but to not a lot of effect when there's still 500 people still being held hostage.
That's right. In fact, one of the interesting aspects to this story about that British couple's release was pointing out how many people are still in captivity, how many hostages there still are there. And that makes it an endemic issue. And you don't treat an endemic issue by securitizing it. And that's certainly the most common phenomenon in politics and geopolitics since 9/11, is treating everything like a security issue. Poverty in Somalia, it's a terrorist threat. Poverty in Africa, we have to drain the swamp. The militarization of all of these different problems, whether it's disputes between clans, whether it is the curse of geography and access to natural resources that many people face, treating everything like a security threat, putting multinational naval forces off the coast of Somalia and all of these things, they just treat symptoms, not causes. And again, this is maybe a case where community-led development is actually ripe to be exercised, because Somalia is not a unified state. It is a highly fractured society along various clan lines. And I think that we should be working with them individually in order to stabilize that country.
Parag, I wanted to pick up on your point about bottom-up solutions rather than top-down rhetoric, as you said. And we have, obviously, notes on you. You speak six languages. Do you think simply teaching people to speak, teaching two or three languages in schools is one of the most obvious ways to sort of get people talking? Talking tends to solve more problems. Having seen certainly films and documentaries on American and British efforts in Afghanistan, it seems that nobody can speak the language, and right, there is no respect because of that. Yeah.
Well, I have an anecdote that I shouldn't necessarily reveal in too much detail, but in the time that I spent with the U.S. military in Iraq, I remember being at a very technologically sophisticated, let's say, facility, and taking a walk late at night with a very senior military officer, And I said to him, is all of this, all of these gizmos, gadgets, television sets, radars, satellites, you name it, encryption devices and so forth, is all of this because you can't speak Arabic? And he kind of chuckled, laughed, and he sort of admitted, yeah, that is the problem. And a related anecdote is that at my office, I get young graduate students coming by all the time saying, I want to be a researcher at a think tank. I want to do this internship and whatever in Washington, in New York, in Boston. And I always say, please don't come talk to me. If I have an invisible sign on my door that says, if you want to stay in the country, don't talk to me. My number one recommendation for all young people who are seeking to have a career in this field is to go travel and to learn a language. And it starts with that. And there's no prescription that's necessary beyond that. It's not work for agency X, Y, and Z, and then you'll be on the right path. It's go and experiment. Go and figure something out for yourself. So I think both of those are partial answers to your question. And, you know, this is a book about diplomacy. That's actually why it's called How to Run the World. It may make for a clever title, but diplomacy is the practice of negotiation.
Should it be how to help others run the world?
Well, you know, help others help themselves. Teach a man to fish is definitely a major subtext. But this is actually meant to be a very serious treatment of diplomacy, which is so often neglected. And some people forget that the title is not how to rule the world, but how to run it. And running is a phrase that connotes management. And diplomacy has been so much about crisis response rather than a consistent structure for management. And that's what diplomacy is supposed to be. And that's what I'm trying to get at in this book.
Parag, I wanted to ask you a question, which I read an interesting piece you wrote about borders in Africa and how perhaps they needed to be redrawn. And perhaps in Africa, countries would be more successful if there are actually fewer of them. And interesting, again, when you talk about the Pashtuns and that maybe the borders there shouldn't be so kind of cast iron, as it were. Do you think that, going back again to that element of diplomacy, that it's time actually for a rethinking of how we see countries and how we see borders and how, you know, we get used to a country being a certain shape on the map, but do you think that we're coming up to a period where that needs to be more fluid, how we see those things?
Absolutely. And, you know, one of the underreported good news stories in the world is the growing deepening of regional institutions like the African Union, the European Union. There is efforts similarly underway in East Asia, in South America. You see it everywhere. What that means very concretely is that countries are building infrastructure across their borders. They're creating joint investment mechanisms and platforms. They're building regional transport corridors, airport hubs, all of these kinds of things as a way of saying, as small landlocked countries, such as many in Africa are, we will not be economically successful. The professor Paul Collier from Oxford calls it agglomeration, and that's just a mouthful way of saying that small economies, small currencies won't really survive and prosper in the 21st century. They need to really integrate as much as possible. And there are very promising examples of this underway in Africa, in fact, where even if the state borders nominally remain the same, after all, they do in Europe. But you can still have phenomenal amounts of activity that effectively bring down those borders. And there are places, Kenya, Tanzania, and other countries have this joint investment promotion stuff. In sub-Saharan Africa, they've created these transboundary conservation parks where the border areas are really safari parks, aren't they? So why treat them like political borders? Why not have joint management of safaris that can be incredibly lucrative and share the profits? So I think that countries in many parts of the world are learning how to manage borders much more effectively and be less wedded to them as we move into the future. And I think that's a very good thing.
I mean, earlier in the program, we had Dr. Claire Spencer on from Chatham House, and we were talking about just the whole notion that the Union for the Mediterranean is stalled, yet again this week. But there, you know, it sort of raises the question that, okay, you know, here you have 43 member countries, you know, trying to pull together what should be an incredibly dynamic region. But then, you know, Claire was sort of arguing, though, it's, you know, in many ways, do you even need a state at a certain point when you have, you know, multinationals and also programs working at a grassroots level, that, you know, do we actually even need these types of institutions? Because Sinopec is going to go in anyway.
Right. Absolutely. And, you know, I would disagree that the Mediterranean Union or even the European Union has suffered the kind of massive setbacks that people always put forward when they see, again, the symptom, which is the failure of a treaty to move forward. Because on the ground, the reality is evolving. The Mediterranean Union has been happening since before Sarkozy made it a popular phrase. The Mediterranean Union is the result of new pipelines being built across the Mediterranean, undersea oil and gas pipelines to Algeria, Tunisia, Libya, and so on. It's the result of the fact that North African countries export 75% of their goods to the European Union. That is the unification across the Mediterranean that is happening through these trade flows, through this investment, through people-to-people exchange. The fact that the real estate prices in Morocco are going through the roof because so many French and Spanish people want to go and retire there and live there, they treat it like a second home. That is how integration happens. Globalization has so many different kinds of pillars on which it rests. And those are examples of how you can, irrespective of treaties or non-treaties, you can have that kind of integration across the Mediterranean, which I think is a very good thing.
Mm. Personal question. I wonder, how do you deal with potential critics or certainly commentators who ask you, you know, don't you feel bad about sort of, you know, burning up the ozone layer as you run around the world to catch a glimpse of things firsthand? I ask this in a very selfish way because I get it all the time myself. Because it's interesting because there's a part of the book where you talk about sort of, you know, Gen Y geopolitics.
Right.
And I think I've sort of, you know, heard part of the theme just now saying, you know, when you want to bring in associates, you tell them to go and see the world. But it runs sort of very counter, I think, in a way. So much of what we hear at the moment is that, well, Gen Y knows everything because they watched it, they witnessed it on YouTube, they can Skype around the world. You know, what do you say to that?
Well, I mean, I think there's multiple questions bound up there. One is, should you have a guilty conscience about traveling a lot? And I didn't get it that much for my first book because I was mostly driving around the world. So it was maybe I should have chosen more fuel efficient vehicles. That's a different sort of complaint. But I think there's no substitute for going out there and seeing it. Books like this can be written sitting in a think tank and reading other people's books. But then I don't think that they would really be adding a whole lot of value. So I don't think there's much to really, argue on that point. But, should one, again, Skype is not a substitute really for going out and making those connections. You know, you Skype to stay in touch with people who you met at some other point in time. And so you wouldn't actually have those connections to deepen and nourish unless you went out and saw the world first.
Mm. I think a lot of people would argue otherwise, though, unfortunately. I mean, I think that's also what, you know, I feel so, you know, we hear all the time now that, you know, that the world of news gathering, you know, can be done by a series of people who actually don't even know what the context is sometimes. Right.
You know, it's interesting, by the way, to your kind of linking back to your other question. There, I know people who use Skype to learn languages because they will, if they want to learn Hindi or Chinese, they set up at the appointed hour a weekly, video conversation with a tutor. And it's a lot cheaper than having someone come to your home in the United States or in the UK.
Mm. Prognosis by the time you get to the end?
By the time you get to the end of the book?
Yes.
I mean, there isn't one answer, right? And the whole this is a book against silver bullets. It's a book that says...
I'll rephrase that. Will people feel elated by the time they get to the end?
Well, you know, the subtitle is Charting a Course to the Next Renaissance, and I'm arguing the world looks like the Middle Ages. It's turbulent, we're afraid, it's unpredictable, there's a lot of crises. But the Renaissance was this period in which technological transformations and ideological transformations combined to create a flourishing of culture. And I believe that that can happen again through the kinds of technological revolutions that we're experiencing today. And this incipient global consciousness that a lot of us talk about and feel. And I think those two can, in fact, combine. And so I do end on an optimistic note.
Great. Perry Connor, the book is How to Run the World. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
You're listening to the Monocle Weekly. We're back in London after this. Back with Monocle Weekly here in London, where Rob has to dash because he's got to get to a brunch.
I certainly do.
I know.
A hot brunch.
A very hot brunch. you were saying earlier on, before we talked to Perry, you're off to Miami because it's Art Basel coming up, right?
Mm-hmm. It certainly is. I should be donning my pink t-shirt, green trousers.
But there's much to do before that because we still have a whole week ahead. We have to finish Monocle Alpino, right, Andrew?
Yeah, but I'm abusing my powers. I'm posting myself to Rome for a day.
I know. I don't know how that happened. Also, Robbie, you know, Andrew's off to Rome to do a culture story as well.
It's absolutely blatant.
There's going to be a lot of rewrites on that one.
I think so.
You're not even getting near it.
Anyway, hopefully you can get a sort of a bit of a vitamin C top up there.
I it's all going to be very healthy.
A little bit of sun.
I've looked at the forecast. There's no sun.
A bit of Spermuta d'Arancia for you.
It's worse than Moscow in a winter's day.
You'll be fine.
Yeah, we'll be
absolutely fine. And then we still have to do the February shoot as well.
Whoa.
And we have to move off, and then we're going to do the TV show.
And the music series.
And yeah, we have to part move office as well.
We're going to have a Christmas party.
Yeah.
Or two.
or two. Yes, listeners, if anyone's in London on December 13th, that's going to be the night of. It's a semi housewarming as well.
It is subscribers though.
It is subscribers. So if you're not a subscriber, please do not send Alexander Mills an email. But if you are, come along. Absolutely. And it's going to be at our new headquarters. You know what the name of the new building is?
Well, I do because I had a peep.
Oh, did you know?
I had a peep on
the invitation.
Midori.
Midori House.
Midori House.
Check that.
Midori. Now, what's that? That's that funny green spirit.
Well, it is something that Suntory makes, which I think you make melon balls out of it.
And it's a melon liqueur.
It's a melon liqueur. Oh, you've really sold that building now. Anyway, Rob, it means
exactly.
Midori in Japanese, Rob, means greenery.
Midori, I know.
Yeah, because your office has a view over the park. That's why we called it Midori. Is that beautiful?
I've met someone called Midori.
I bet you have.
People look up from the park; they can see your Midori swim.
Oh dear. That's all for this week's edition of the Monocle Weekly. Today's show is produced by Alexander Mills right here in London, and our sound engineer was Dom Boucher, or Boucher if you live in the UK. If you have any thoughts or comments for today's show, then do drop us a note to weekly@monocle.com, and remember you can catch up with us daily via our monocolumn on our site. Also, our bumper December-January issue is now on most newsstands around the world, so flex your muscles and attempt to pick up a copy. Next week we're back in London, but for now I'm Tyler Brulé.
I'm Andrew Tuck.
And I'm Robert Pound.
Goodbye.